Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated January 3rd, 2014. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Welcome to the 2014 first reading of the Triangle Business Journal. This week's lead articles is entitled Triangle Titans, an inside look at seven people who helped build and shape the Triangle into one of the nation's most desirable places to live and work. Those titans include the coach, Mike Krzyzewski, the governor, James B. Hunt, Jr., the collaborators, the Goodmans, the pioneer, O. Temple Sloan, Jr., and the patrons, the Goodnights. This week's first titan, the governor, James B. Hunt, Jr., a tireless public servant who helped North Carolina become a beacon of progress in the South. By Rebecca Troyer, from Raleigh. Former North Carolina Governor James Baxter Jim Hunt Jr. says he first started worrying about the state's economy as an undergraduate at NC State University in the late 1950s as he watched textile jobs flee the state. Immersed in a science-oriented institution, he knew the answer had to lie in developing new industries founded on concepts that hadn't yet been invented and skills that traditional farm and factory workers didn't possess. By the time he had secured the office of Lieutenant Governor in 1972, tobacco and furniture had reached the list of North Carolina's endangered industries. Unemployment was among the highest in the nation. During this time, Hunt resolved to execute an agenda that would underscore his record four terms as governor, 1977 to 1985 and 1993 to 2001. And his entire public service career based on a simple but unyielding principle. The beating heart of economic survival and advancement, whether in individuals, a communities, or a state, was education. Brain power, he calls it, in a recent interview in his office in the James B. Hunt Library on North Carolina State's Centennial Campus. The Triangle, with its massive research park, three major universities and prime amenities for recruiting technology, and pharmaceutical companies would play a key role in and become a chief beneficiary of Governor Hunt's economic strategy for the state. The Microelectronics Center and the North Carolina Biotechnology Center at RTP, the North Carolina School of Science and Mathematics in Durham, the Institute for Emerging Issues and the Centennial Campus Project at NC State University in Raleigh, and the James B. Hunt Institute for Educational Leadership Policy at UNC Chapel Hill, along with the dozens of companies he helped to recruit in the Triangle, all reflect his lifelong commitment to the marriage of strong education policy and economic health. During the past five decades, Hunt's legacy has, in essence, become the Triangle's legacy. In hindsight, it may seem obvious that North Carolina had to actively seek new types of industries, but in the 1970s, there were obstacles. The business community was very hidebound, says Gary Pierce, who served as Hunt's press secretary. There was resistance to bringing in new ideas and people. There was a native streak in this state that didn't want to change. For example, when Hunt became governor, the state had no formal structure for helping attract businesses to settle here. There was no Commerce Department until Hunt created it. Hunt, who still today says you have to be as aggressive as you can be in recruiting companies, felt as governor that he should play an active role. He traveled to London three times to recruit pharmaceutical giant Glaxo. He traveled through Europe and made 25 trips to Japan. He drove the Commerce Department's industrial recruiters like he drove campaign aides. He wore out two sets of security men, one shift in the morning and another shift in the afternoon and night, Pierce writes in his 2010 biography of Hunt. Hunt realized that North Carolina was competing not just with other states, but the world. Incentives were part of the formula, not the only component. Most companies come here for the universities, the community colleges, and the schools, not cheap labor or cheap taxes, Hunt says. My friend Bob Ingram told me more than once that the main incentive to ask about in recruiting the best and brightest was whether there were good universities and good schools. That is our calling card. It's what makes us so different from the rest of the South. Ingram, who served as CEO of Glaxo Welcome and led its merger consolidation as GlaxoSmithKline, chairs the board of the Research Triangle Park Foundation and serves on the board of the Hunt Education Leadership and Policy Institute. Bob Giolis, president and CEO of the RTP Foundation, works in Hunt's administration and then at NCSU's Centennial Campus, which Hunt was instrumental in establishing as a collaboration of industry and academic research. He, better than anyone, knows that RTP wouldn't be successful without a strong commitment to education, Giolis says. Without our universities, RTP just becomes a land deal. Hunt wasn't just focused on higher education and research. He believed the state's commitment to education had to begin early in a child's development, before that child ever walked into a public school classroom. Project Smart Start, an early childhood education initiative backed by the North Carolina General Assembly, was largely Hunt's brainchild, a project that captured his attention during the in-between years out of office. Funding for the project wasn't an easy sell, and its eventual passage was emblematic of the moderate Hunt's unique ability to bring Republicans and Democrats together. And, as often was the case, he accomplished this by involving business leaders who were more interested in economic policies than politics. The man Hunt tapped to head up the Smart Start pitch was Jim Goodman of Capital Broadcasting Company, owner of WRAL-TV. Iconically, where Hunt's former U.S. Senate opponent Jesse Helms had delivered his ultra-conservative editorials. Goodman was as passionate as Hunt about early education, and he helped give credibility to the project during its critical launch period. Hunt led the charge on the state's first standardized testing of students, and he established a process for teachers to be rewarded for obtaining national board certification. Today, thanks to these efforts, North Carolina has one-fifth of the nation's board-certified teachers. Asked whether our current educational system needs to be reformed, Hunt, as always, ties his answer to the economy. Education needs both support and reform, he says. We've given teachers a 1% raise in the past 5 years. We're losing many to South Carolina, where pay is higher. I believe you win by investing in people, in creativity, in innovation, and in skills. That's how we've always won. Hunt and his wife Carolyn still live on their Wilson County farm, overseeing their cattle-raising operation. And the former governor still commutes from his home to the Triangle almost daily, driving down the James B. Hunt Memorial Highway to his Centennial Campus office or meetings in the area. The Hunt children have inherited the governor's passion for the public good. Two of his three daughters, Rachel and Elizabeth, have educated-related careers. Daughter Rebecca is a nurse practitioner who runs a free clinic in Goldsboro. Son Baxter is in the U.S. Foreign Service in Afghanistan working on eradication of poppies, a major source of illegal heroin. Even today, Hunt reads 5 newspapers a day and is immersed in a biography of Lyndon Johnson and the latest John Grisham novel. He mentors young political hopefuls and stays close to the initiatives that he worked so hard to implement while in office. He remains an active leader of his 2 public policy boards at NCSU and UNCCH. We have to keep the focus on new things, he says, new products, new thinking, creative people. We have to invest in education at all levels, in great teachers who challenge their students, and we can't do it on the cheap. Titan number 2, the coach, Mike Krzyzewski, how a world-renowned basketball legacy helped build a community's brand, by Jesse Burkhart, from Durham. In 1980, Mike Krzyzewski left West Point, New York, with tools he would still be using more than three decades later. After nearly 10 years spent at the United States Military Academy as a student and basketball coach, the government institution that manufactures leaders as part of its mission statement had done just that with Krzyzewski. When the 33-year-old was hired as a head coach on the men's basketball team at Duke University, he understood what it took to mold young men. Krzyzewski got off to a rocky start at Duke as the Blue Devils went 38-47 during his first three seasons. The kind of seasons that may have gotten him fired in a 21st century sports culture that demands immediate results or else. But he soon turned the program into a powerhouse. During his 33-year tenure at Duke, he has collected four national titles, produced dozens of NBA players, and led the United States to two gold medals during the 2008 and 2012 Summer Olympics as head coach of the national men's basketball team. Today, Krzyzewski, age 66, is the winningest coach in NCAA Division I men's basketball history and is popularly considered among the greatest in the history of team sports. In the process, Duke University has gained the kind of brand recognition that spans multiple time zones, and the city of Durham entered the national spotlight because that's where the Blue Devils live. You get national and international marketability as a result of not just having a team that's good, but a team that's won championships and have won championships with great kids, Krzyzewski says. Whenever we're in those situations, we always say, we're from Durham. We live in Durham, North Carolina. And the world gets to see that because it's such a high-profile sport. To describe how the success of the basketball program has raised the profile of the school, Duke University President Dr. Richard Broadhead borrows an analogy from Krzyzewski. Mike often says that the basketball program is designed to function like the store window at a high-end department store, Dr. Broadhead says. It's to catch the eye of passers-by and alert them to the fact that there's fantastic stuff inside. Born in Chicago, Krzyzewski was raised by a father who was an elevator operator and a mother who worked nights as a cleaning woman. But he was determined to not let his educational opportunities be limited by his parents' income. Recruited to play basketball in the United States Military Academy, Krzyzewski earned his degree after playing from 1966 to 1969 under head coach Bobby Knight, who later moved on to coach at Indiana University. Krzyzewski then served as an officer in the Army and earned the rank of captain before following Knight to Indiana to work as a graduate assistant. He returned to West Point in 1975, serving as head coach of the Army Cadets for five seasons. Krzyzewski calls the U.S. Military Academy the best leadership school in the world, crediting his years at West Point for informing the leadership style he brought to Duke. My leadership style is constantly changing, and it needs to change somewhat because of the people you lead, he says. But the basic foundation of it is the development of trust. In other words, you're always truthful with the people you lead, and you're always prepared. I think you should always show courage and have a value-based leadership that can be trusted. If you have trust from the person or people you're leading, good things are going to happen. Of all the young men who have passed through the Duke basketball program, perhaps no one embodies Krzyzewski's leadership qualities better than Grant Hill and Shane Battier, whom Krzyzewski calls two of the greatest leaders to pass through the Duke basketball program. Both players won national championships and garnered numerous accolades during their years at Duke before enjoying sustained careers in the NBA. But it's not their on-court success that made them archetypical Blue Devils, but rather the way they absorbed the instruction of their leader and then applied it beyond basketball. For as good of a basketball coach as he is, his strength is teaching young men virtues of togetherness, responsibility, accountability, things that you could apply to any walk of life. He does it in a way that makes perfect sense in a basketball context, Battier says. Grant Hill echoes Battier, saying that if Coach K weren't a coach, then he would have been equally as successful at a Fortune 500 company or investment bank. Coach K is a relationship guy, he says. He's the type of person who really values and understands how to connect with people. He embraces the differences in everyone. His ability to motivate and inspire me might have been entirely different with a Shane Battier. I think that's the beauty of his leadership style. It's not a cookie-cutter approach. He truly is a leader who just so happens to coach basketball. Although Krzyzewski is employed by Duke to coach basketball, he understands that tough responsibilities come with the territory, and he has embraced them. Perhaps there was never a time when Krzyzewski's visibility was put to such good use as when the Duke lacrosse scandal dominated national headlines during the spring of 2006. As the nation awaited the university's most recognizable figure to speak on the matter, Krzyzewski controversially waited several months before speaking publicly. When he did, he called it the most trying time he had seen at the school, saying he withheld comment because he thought it was appropriate, as the basketball coach, to remember his place and remain behind the scenes. But Krzyzewski wasn't far from the fray. All along, he had been providing guidance and insight to school officials, including Broadhead, as the university emerged from its biggest public relations nightmare in history. When it came time to announce the lacrosse team's new interim coach, his presence at the news conference signaled the gravity of the situation while delivering a calm over it. Krzyzewski's role in the Duke lacrosse scandal was an example of how he had transcended his place as basketball coach, even if he never intended to. When he isn't helping restore the university's public image, Krzyzewski is helping build other university properties. Krzyzewski currently serves as an executive in residence with Duke's Fuqua School of Business and is instrumental in helping raise money for the school and the Duke Children's Hospital. He has even been enlisted by Dr. Victor Dazal, CEO of the Duke Health System, in the recruiting process of doctors. He functions in a lot of different ways for us, Broadhead says. Now, let's put it this way. He's not only perhaps the greatest basketball coach ever, he's probably as good of a citizen of the university as there ever was. Beyond the university, Krzyzewski's top civic service priority is the Emily Krzyzewski Center, a Duke educational nonprofit established in 2006 and named for his late mother. The center serves about 1,500 youth per month from nearly 40 different schools in the area to help prepare them for college. We're very proud of what's going on there, Krzyzewski says. To me, it's also a connection for the Durham community to see how Duke is involved because I'm the Duke basketball coach. Supporting Krzyzewski's humanitarian efforts is his wife, Mickey, whom he credits for organizing his off-the-court obligations and says understands the community even better than he does. The pair insists they not receive credit for their public service to Durham, as Krzyzewski says anything being done for the recognition's sake is not being done for the right reason. But at this point, recognition will be difficult to avoid. After 33 years at Duke, Mike Krzyzewski has made himself into an internationally known figure, using his basketball legacy to not just elevate his university and his community, but bind them together. Titan number 3, the patrons, Jim and Ann Goodnight. Innovators, art supporters, and education advocates whose legacy extends far beyond the SAS campus. By Lauren K. Onisorge. From Cary. Holes. There's something you wouldn't think fiercely private billionaire Jim Goodnight would know anything about. The CEO of SAS and the man behind its sprawling Cary campus, more of a self-contained village than a typical software headquarters, complete with hair salon and a sushi bar, can certainly afford to pay people to dig, at least in the literal sense. With an estimated wealth of $12.8 billion, according to Bloomberg, he maintains the title of richest man in North Carolina. A former faculty member at NC State University, he co-founded SAS in 1976 and has been creating his wealth for more than three decades, along with his wife, Anne. In 2012, SAS had an estimated revenue of $2.87 billion, and Goodnight had a 66% stake in the company. But both through videos released by his company and talking points he frequently delivers, he'll tell you holes are something a CEO needs to know about. Once you've dug a hole deep enough, get out and start a new hole, he advises in one video. It's his best advice. The problem with some CEOs not on that Bloomberg list, they keep digging. Big, deep holes are very expensive, Goodnight says, adding that his peers sometimes don't know when to stop funneling money into a project. They don't realize that, even when it's completed, no one may be interested in it. So at some point, you've got to say, okay, we've lost enough money in this, let's try something different. That's what he did in the 1990s when SAS had its own game group, rising to the number six developer in the country with $55 million in revenue in 2000. But for that $55 million, I was paying $85 million in expenses, he says. I didn't see a projection that would say at a certain point this is going to break even. So he stopped digging and moved on. He did the same thing when he sank cash into a little airline called Midway. The dot-com bubble broke and he saw the writing on the wall, stopping his investment. When you've dug a hole deep enough, get out of it, he says. Don't keep digging. After all, the Goodnights have enough ongoing digging sites. And the state's wealthiest power couple have focused their shovels outside the software sphere and into an issue they've been involved in for well over a decade. The pair founded Cary Academy in 1996, an event Goodnight spoke about at a recent forum sponsored by the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce. I think it was probably the second drink of wine out on our back porch, he jokes of the idea. We had an experience. Our son was in middle school, public school, and one particular teacher was causing problems. Anne went to talk to the teacher, and the teacher said, "Look, lady, I don't have enough time," he says. I'm sure that occurs at many schools, just this particular one was enough to put us over the edge. For most people, that might mean switching teachers, schools, maybe even homeschooling, but not for the Goodnights. They decided to create a new school altogether, teaming up with SAS co-founder John Sayle and his wife Ginger to create Cary Academy. But it wasn't enough just to create a school. Goodnight wanted this school to emphasize technology. It's very clear kids are going to be digital, he says. Today, he's looking outside the halls of Cary Academy. The Goodnights, along with fellow leaders such as Brad Wilson, CEO of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, have created BEST-NC, which stands for Business for Educational Success and Transformation in North Carolina. We just think business needs to play a more active role, says Walter McDowell, a retired Wachovia executive and the group's chairman. Goodnight himself has been taking every opportunity to soapbox what he believes is a significant skills gap in the workforce. People who simply don't have the high-tech skills required to fill job openings at places such as SAS. We actually have to wait up to 2 years to fill some of our positions, he told the chamber crowd. And he's not the only one speaking. In an editorial at the close of the 2013 North Carolina General Assembly session, Anne wrote that she was left stunned by what she saw as a glaring lack of support for public education. Education isn't the Goodnight's only platform. Anne Goodnight is also a patron of the arts. It's obvious just by taking a look at the sprawling SAS campus, where you'll find approximately 3,000 pieces of art. There are two residential artists and designers that select potential pieces for the collection, but the final say goes to Anne Goodnight, says SAS spokesperson Allison Lane. Additionally, the Goodnights are very protective of Cary. Since moving SAS to its current location in 1980, Jim Goodnight has proven he's not above buying a property to keep it from being developed in a way that would offset the SAS vibe. And SAS isn't his only project. He also developed Prestonwood Country Club and the Umstead Hotel and Spa. Titan number four, the collaborators, Jim and Barbara Goodman, keeping the triangle connected with the world and bringing new life to the Durham cityscape. By Jason DeBrun, from Raleigh. Most people in the Triangle probably interact with Jim Goodman in some way or another on an almost daily basis. Of course, they don't necessarily see the man himself, but whether they connect through WRAL online or the TV station, through the American Tobacco Campus in Durham, or the Durham Bulls baseball team, nearly everyone in the Triangle probably has a touchpoint with Goodman more than once a week. Born James Fletcher Goodman in 1943, he now goes more often by Jim, and attended high school in Raleigh and Duke University from 1961 to 65. He married Barbara Lyons after meeting her while serving his enlistment in Memphis, Tennessee, and brought her back to Raleigh in 1968 when he joined WRAL-TV as operations manager. In 1973, he took on corporate responsibilities as executive vice president of Capital Broadcasting Company. In 1975, he became CBC's president, and in 1979, he was named president and CEO of the company, the position he still holds today. Subsidiaries of his company have included WRAL-TV, a CBS affiliate, and WRAL-FM, both in Raleigh, WJZY-TV in Charlotte, and the North Carolina News Network, which includes more than 90 radio affiliates statewide. Goodman's flagship station, WRAL-TV, pioneered coverage in computerized elections and microwave and satellite news gathering. It was the Southeast's first station to use a jet helicopter to cover news. Barbara Goodman has taken over a philanthropic role. She graduated from St. Joseph's School of Nursing in Memphis, Tennessee in 1965, and is also a graduate of Meredith College and the master's program in liberal studies at NC State University. She now serves as the president of the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, which the Goodmans formed to support various nonprofit ventures. She has said the foundation will be flexible in its funding, supporting a broad range of causes while also becoming an effective voice for human services statewide and in the Triangle. Barbara Goodman has served on a number of community boards in the Triangle. With primary interest in the field of human services, she has served as chairwoman of the Salvation Army, vice chair of the Healing Place of Wake County, and chair of Wake County Human Services. She has received the William Booth Award from the Salvation Army and was inducted into the Academy of Women of the Raleigh YWCA. Michael Goodman, the Goodman's son, is involved in the business as well. He runs the real estate arm of Capital Broadcasting, which has made some major investments in the American Tobacco Campus in Durham, particularly through American Underground. In fact, after originally developing much of the campus, Capital, through an affiliate called ATC North Residential LLC, is even buying some of the properties back. The historic Old Bull and Noel buildings, for example, are slated for renovation work to be completed in early 2014, according to Michael Goodman. As North Carolina has become a decidedly purple state when it comes to recent elections, markets like Charlotte and Raleigh-Durham have seen increased action from political candidates and their political action committees, also known as PACs. Indeed, various campaign analysis firms put the Raleigh-Durham market as a top five market in terms of political ad spending in the 2012 national election, which served as a boon for the television affiliate. As a Democrat in a city with an increasingly Republican leadership, Jim Goodman has taken on some new advocacy roles. For example, he serves on Best NC, which stands for Business for Education Success and Transformation North Carolina, and will advocate for businesses around the state who want to improve North Carolina's public education system. Others, including Ann Goodnight of SAS and Brad Wilson of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, also serve on this group's board. He has also been outspoken about some of the new policies by Republican lawmakers. "We're turning back everything that made us different from other southern states," he said in an interview with Bloomberg. "With this shift, economic development is broken." He even took a hard line at Governor Pat McCrory and Budget Director Art Pope, one of the wealthiest conservatives in the state and a major political donor. When McCrory made Pope the budget director, he became a puppet, Goodman said, according to the Bloomberg article. Among Goodman's honors was being the 2003 Tar Heel of the Year by the News and Observer, the newspaper's highest honor. In an accompanying article, the NNO praised Goodman for his contributions to the Triangle and the world of broadcasting. In an editorial, newspaper's former executive editor, Melanie Sill, said the editors chose Goodman because of his involvement and influence in two arenas, the redevelopment of Durham's American Tobacco Complex and the national debate about how many TV and radio stations a single media company should be allowed to own. In 2004, Goodman received Duke University's Futrell Award for Excellence in the Field of Communications and Journalism. The Futrell Award, given each year by Duke's DeWitt Wallace Center for Communications and Journalism, was established in honor of Ashley B. Futrell, Sr., publisher of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Daily News. It is awarded annually to a Duke alumnus who has made distinctions and contributions to the field of field communications. Goodman received the award because he has guided the growth of its radio and television holdings, as well as its expansion into innovative businesses such as satellite communications, the Internet, high-definition television, and high-definition radio. Flagship station WRAL-TV was among the nation's first to broadcast in high-definition, according to Duke. Goodman has received several other honors, including the Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Mid-South Chapter of the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. He was inducted into the North Carolina Association of Broadcasters Hall of Fame and the UNC Chapel Hill School of Journalism and Mass Communications Journalism Hall of Fame. He also earned the Earl Gluck Distinguished Service to Broadcasting Award from the North Carolina Association of Broadcasters. Titan Number 5, The Pioneer. O. Temple Sloan, Jr., a consummate businessman and master dealmaker who believes success should be shared. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh. When it was announced in October that General Parts International, the auto parts company that O. Temple Sloan Jr. started 50 years ago in Raleigh, was to be sold for more than $2 billion, many thought Sloan would be an instant billionaire. But like most of the acquisitions and mergers that Sloan, age 74, has helped craft throughout his career, he'll be sharing most of that cash with those around him. That includes the CarQuest store manager in rural North Carolina who's earned shares for decades through the company's profit-sharing plan that Sloan set up in 1968, and the Boy Scouts of America programs that he's supported for decades. The GPI stock ownership plan had more than 11,600 participants and $117 million in assets at the end of 2012, according to U.S. Department of Labor filings. Each shareholder stands to get a share of that $2 billion pie when the deal closes in early 2014. That's the way Sloan has always done business, carrying people along for the ride. Never one to seek publicity, awards, or applause, Temple Sloan Jr. has quietly orchestrated some of the biggest deals impacting North Carolina's business economy, close associates say, and perhaps helped make more men millionaires in North Carolina than any other individual. Gerald Thornton, a partner at the Manning Fulton Law Firm in Raleigh, who has helped Sloan craft General Parts merger and acquisition deals for the past 40 years, says that while Sloan prefers not to toot his own horn, he's had plenty to toot about. "I can tell you that the customer and his people are always on his mind," Thornton says. "If it was not a win-win, he always said it was a transaction that probably shouldn't take place." It was Sloan, along with Raleigh real estate executives Roddy Jones, Steve Stroud, and Ron Gibson, who bought into the first Raleigh office buildings that would become a foundation for Highwoods Properties and the real estate investment trust that went public in 1994. Sloan has since day one served as Highwoods board chairman, a company that now has a market cap of $5.4 billion with real estate holdings across the country. He's also invested in concrete mixing companies, auto dealerships, restaurants, the Carolina Hurricanes hockey team, and many other businesses in North Carolina throughout the country through his two private investment firms, Trail Creek Investments Incorporated and Sheshire Creek Company, named for a creek near his home and ranch in Montana. Sloan politely declined to be interviewed for this story, but business leaders describe Sloan as always being committed to integrity and honor, lessons he learned growing up in Sanford, earning his way to Eagle Scout, and as the son of O.T. Sloan Sr., a successful Stanford businessman. As the story goes, Sloan Jr. was still a student at Duke University when he helped his father open a small loan office in Elizabeth City. Sloan Jr. would make a four-hour drive twice a week after classes to make loans, collect payments, and manage their small staff there. One of the deals that the Sloans made was with the owner of General Parts Warehouse in Sanford. The business was in financial trouble, but Sloan Jr. saw bigger possibilities for it. By the summer of 1961, he had graduated from Duke University and was married with two children when he decided to move General Parts and his family to Raleigh. There, he built his first 20,000-square-foot warehouse building on land he purchased from well-known businessman and philanthropist A.E. Finley, a man who remained a mentor to Sloan thereafter. Sloan was awarded the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce's A.E. Finley Distinguished Service Award in 2012. In that warehouse deal, Sloan also had help from C.B. Jones, a partner in the Davidson Jones construction firm, and Jones' son, Roddy, would later become a partner in many of Sloan's ventures. Sloan also made friends with business leaders across the state. He serves on the board of directors for the Golden Corral Corporation Restaurant Group and retired from the board at Lowe's Companies Incorporated in 2011. He was recruited in 1966 to serve on the board of Nations Bank by then bank chairman and CEO Hugh McColl, Jr., and served 13 years as a director as its successor company, Bank of America. Sloan resigned from the Bank of America board, however, in 2009 under pressure from shareholders who were unhappy with the bank's merger with Merrill Lynch, a deal that eventually led to the ousting of bank CEO Ken Lewis, whom Sloan had supported as successor to McColl. McColl has also served on Sloan's board at General Parts International. Sloan, Jones, and several others in his circles became big supporters of the Boy Scouts of America and its Okinichi Council of North Carolina. Sloan has served on the BSA National Executive Board and still serves on its advisory council. He was awarded the program's top honor, the Silver Buffalo Award, in 2010. Rex Thomas, a principal in the Evison Young real estate firm in Raleigh, was working for the Boy Scouts in 1970 when he first met Sloan. "He's hardly changed at all," Thomas says. "He's still just as humble and extremely intelligent businessman as he was back then." And then Thomas resigned from the Boy Scouts. The first person he called was Sloan, who encouraged him to go to work at Highwoods Properties, a company only 14 months old at the time. "It was the best advice he ever gave me," Thomas says, "and he's been a mentor for me ever since." Another mentee is Ed Fritch, president and CEO of Highwoods Properties, who rose through the company ranks to earn the company's top executive spot in 2004. But Fritch says it hasn't always been easy. Temple makes the term tenacious competitor look meek, and he has a work ethic that defies science, Fritch says. It was also in 2004 that Sloan announced he was turning leadership of General Parts over to his son, Temple Sloan III, who has been working his way through just about every department of the company over the previous 21 years. While Sloan Jr. remains chairman at General Parts, he will serve only as an advisor once the anticipated sale of General Parts to Advance Auto Parts is completed in early 2014. Sloan III will stay with the company as president of General Parts and is expected to join the board of directors of Advance Auto Parts. But nobody would venture to say that Sloan Jr. is ready to retire. "He does love the outdoors, and he'll probably spend more time at his ranch," Thomas says, "but his mind is working 24/7. I don't expect that to change much." You've just heard the description and the rise of five titans of the Triangle, the Research Triangle Park here in North Carolina. Mike Krzyzewski, James B. Hunt Jr., the Goodmans, O. Temple Sloan Jr., and the Goodnights. From the Triangle Business Journal, January 3rd, 2014. Next up, Executive Voice, Jill Wells Heath. Leadership by Design. This article is by Rebecca Troyer. Founded in 1983 by Barbara Mulkey, Mulkey Engineers and Consultants is a mid-sized, woman-owned civil and environmental engineering firm that enables clients to transform everyday challenges into everyday achievements. The company is headquartered in Cary, with offices in Charlotte, Newberry, South Carolina, and Columbus and Metro Atlanta. President and CEO Jill Wells Heath began working for Mulkey as an outside accountant, and in 2003 was hired as in-house as Mulkey's chief financial officer. In 2006, she became president, and in 2008, she became CEO. Question by TBJ. Back when you were a CPA, did you ever think you'd end up working for a client? What led you to that decision? Ms. Heath. When I left corporate America to start my CPA practice, I said that I would never go back. Well, never say what you won't do. I fell in love with Barbara H. Mulkey Engineering, Incorporated. I also could not imagine anyone else being responsible for Mulkey's financial well-being. So when the time came and Barbara Mulkey made me an offer to join the company full-time, I couldn't refuse. Triangle Business Journal. What were your greatest challenges making the transition from CFO to CEO? Ms. Heath. Accountants and engineers are different in many ways, but similar in others. Engineers want evidence. They don't want you to tell them how capable you are. They want you to show them how capable you are. Having been with Mulkey from the beginning, I was given the opportunity to assimilate into the engineering world. My transition was more of an evolution, and by the time I was named president, then CEO, I was no stranger to the intricacies of the industry. I had been given the chance to prove myself. TBJ, what sort of culture do you try to bring to Mulkey's workplace? What strategies do you employ to retain talented staff? Ms. Heath, Mulkey isn't the family I was born into. It's the family that I chose. I hope all of our employees feel the same. I genuinely care about and respect each and every employee, and they tell me it shows. I make a point of saying hello to everyone in the morning. I give hugs. I think we all embrace one another. To give an example, our employees just pulled together to buy a chairlift for our dear receptionist, who suffered a stroke and had been unable to reach the second floor of her own home. That's the kind of culture we have at Mulkey. As for retaining our employees, while we do our best in many ways to keep them happy, we offer flex schedule to accommodate the demands of family life. We provide a competitive benefits package. We have a wellness plan to promote their good health. We have fun, but we work hard, because the best way to retain staff is to have a strong and successful company. TBJ, you're very active in volunteer board positions. Is this part of being a good CEO, or is this simply your personal style? How do you juggle time demands between profit-making work and nonprofit activities? Ms. Heath, as Jill Heath, the citizen, and as Jill Heath, the CEO, I think it's important to be active in the community and within the industry. The communities that we serve have blessed us, and it's our responsibility to give back to them. I am also blessed to have a leadership team that supports my nonprofit activity. TBJ, your company has been woman-owned since its inception. How should we be recruiting more young people, and particularly women, into STEM jobs? Ms. Heath, we must expose the younger generations to STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. I'm so impressed by the Wake North Carolina State University STEM Early College High School and would like to see more programs like this. I believe that if more young women were exposed to the opportunities in STEM fields, they would go for it. Women are problem solvers, which is really what engineering is all about. TBJ, what challenges has the engineering business faced in the past couple of years? Ms. Heath, what challenges haven't we faced in recent years? The economy has been devastating to our industry, but I always knew that Mulkey would make it to the other side and be stronger for it. We went on a diet in 2008, and we've learned to live smart and lean to survive. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. TBJ, have you ever tried a business strategy that didn't really work the way you thought it would, such that you had to regroup and shift directions? Ms. Heath, we are ever evolving to best fit our clients' ever-changing needs. We've had a discipline-based business model, a location-based business model, and now we're a hybrid. We keep a finger on the pulse of the industry and react accordingly. TBJ, what book are you currently reading? Ms. Heath, I am reading Beyond Belief, Awaken Potential, Focus Leadership by Dr. John Grinnell. TBJ, what are your hobbies? Ms. Heath, I exercise. I love road biking and boating. I read when I can, and I buy shoes. Lots and lots of beautiful shoes. TBJ, what's your favorite smartphone app? Ms. Heath, we recently launched our company intranet, The Point, and I'm obsessed. So my favorite app is the Jive app that lets me stay connected to it. I love being able to be in the know even when I'm away from the office. I also love Spider Solitaire. And now it's time for a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. This column is by Todd Cohen. FIGS help low-income residents obtain the medicines they need. For the past 31 years, more than 37,000 people have received more than $2.5 million worth of medicine thanks to FIGS, an all-volunteer Raleigh nonprofit that helps pay for prescription drugs for residents of Wake County who otherwise could not afford medication. We are assisting people who are working with no insurance or insufficient insurance, says Myra Brickle, treasurer and former president of the board of directors of FIGS and a pharmacist at Student Health Services at NC State University. Formerly known as Filling in Gaps, FIGS, FIGS, grew out of a conversation that representatives of downtown churches had in 1982 with officials of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. The group asked what the department's greatest need was, and the officials replied it was prescription drug assistance for low-income people, particularly those who were elderly or chronically ill. Many of the people we assist are people who actually work, Brickle says, because many of its clients have chronic illnesses, including diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and mental illness, she says. The support they receive helps keep them out of emergency rooms, which they also cannot afford. That small investment, she says, helps clients stay healthy while also reducing the cost to taxpayers on emergency room care. FIGS coordinates its program with urban ministries of Wake County, as well as local physicians and pharmacists. Sam McLean, crisis support director at Urban Ministries, says the agency's clients often must make tough trade-offs between paying for medication they need and paying for rent, utilities, and food. Without FIGS, it would be difficult on people, he says. Do I get my medication, or do I feed my kids? FIGS created a program for urban ministries to train its staff and volunteers to interview clients who need assistance with prescription drugs. For a client who qualifies for assistance, staff at urban ministries phone the pharmacy the client selects, get a price estimate, and give the client a voucher to take to the pharmacy, along with a prescription. The client gets the medicine and pays nothing. The pharmacy collects receipts from clients and sends a statement to FIGS at its post office box, which is the closest thing we have to an office, says Brickle, who retrieves the statements and pays the pharmacies. The patient never has the money in hand, she says. The pharmacy bills us directly. FIGS which has an endowment with the Wake County Community Foundation, an affiliate of North Carolina Community Foundation, pays about $140,000 a year for prescription drugs for roughly 900 people. And 99% of its budget is used to pay for prescription drugs, with the remainder paying for the post office box, postage, and a brochure it uses in an annual fundraising appeal. The organization receives support from about churches, foundations, individuals, and the city of Raleigh, and it plans to expand its 10-member board as part of an effort to raise money to address clients' needs. Demand is greater than we can support, Brickle says. In other nonprofit news, Santa's elves donned in leather jackets this holiday as 200 motorcycle riders hit the streets for the annual Toys for Tots ride, sponsored by Ray Price Harley-Davidson and the Raleigh Harley Owners Group, also known as HOG. Throughout November and December, the Ray Price dealership collected donated toys and bicycles to share with low-resource youth in our community. In all, Raleigh HOG, Walmart, and Ray Price donated 80 bicycles and $2,500 in cash and toys to the U.S. Marines Toys for Tots. Also, Power Home Technologies, a Morrisville-based security systems company, raised $35,000 during its 2013 campaign and will donate that amount to Make-A-Wish. This marks the fourth year that Power Home Technologies has supported Make-A-Wish. More than $83,000 has been given by PHT customers and employees to Make-A-Wish Eastern North Carolina. And finally this week, the Raleigh affiliate of the National Christian Foundation surpassed the $50 million threshold in giving. As of November 1st, the foundation has given a total of $50,036,100 through 12,800 grants to more than 1,600 organizations at the local, state, national, and international levels since January 2005. This week's Editor's Notebook by Sugata Mukherjee, who is the editor of Triangle Business Journal, is entitled Titans Gave Triangle Its Identity. A couple of months ago, when we first started talking about the centerpiece feature for our first issue of 2014, we identified two priorities. The feature needs to be personality-based, and it needs to have star power. The Triangle's population is transient. As people come and leave, we often forget about some of the influencers in the community who have been amid us for decades and have had a profound effect on the brand that is Raleigh-Durham Chapel Hill. So when we were talking about people to profile in this issue, the editorial team came up with a set of names. These names: four-time North Carolina Governor Jim Hunt, Jim and Ann Goodnight, Jim and Barbara Goodman, Temple Sloan, and legendary Duke University men's basketball coach Mike Krzyzewski have excelled at their professions for decades, but in the process they did something else. They gave the Triangle an identity. There is no doubt that we could have filled up several more pages with additional names of individuals whose contribution to our communities are everlasting and transformational. In the end, however, we looked for people whose belief and diversity of thought may have made many of us better. Jim Hunt stood out for his relentless pursuit to make North Carolinians pay attention to primary and higher education. He is many things, but his legacy will be tied to his willingness to fight the battle of keeping the state legislature focused on education during all of his terms. One could argue that he had a willing partner, the Democrats, who had majority status in the legislature during all his terms. Mike Krzyzewski is an international figure, and he has deftly used his prominence and influence to promote the university and the town with vigor. But once reporter Jesse Burkhart sat down and started talking to him for his feature, Coach K's passion for life and leadership values reflected a personality that goes so much deeper than being a basketball coach. SAS founder Jim Goodnight and his wife Ann have had their names on so many Triangle accomplishments that a thousand-word piece is unlikely to do justice. While Jim Goodnight builds his world-class software company from Cary, his wife Ann is making sure the Triangle's and by extension North Carolina's image as the flag bearer of progressive South is restored. She dives into education, arts, and philanthropy and unapologetically fights for people who may not have a voice of their own. Capital Broadcasting founder Jim Goodman and his wife Barbara have built fixtures around Raleigh and Durham, lent their voices to causes in our communities, and always, I mean always, never shied away from having a contrarian viewpoint. Perhaps that's why Goodman is so successful at running his media business, and his wife Barbara is held in such reverence in this part of the world. And finally, O. Temple Sloan Jr., the humble businessman who has built or played a role in building so much of this town, all while running his company, General Parts International. Sloan, a shy but strong and emphatic man, is far from done helping this community following the $2 billion sale of his company this year. But as usual, he will do it in a quiet and unassuming fashion. We hope you have enjoyed this week's feature, and as we embark on a brand new year, I can promise you that we will be following these individuals in our communities and chronicling their future endeavors. After all, they are the Triangle's Titans. Two well-known figures in the Triangle real estate market, Billy Redmond and Rod Webb, have been named as the first two appointees to the new North Carolina Education and Workforce Innovation Commission, according to Governor Pat McCrory's office. Redmond, CEO of Trademark Properties in Raleigh, and Webb, Senior Vice President and Raleigh City Executive for Newbridge Bank, will each serve a two-year term on the 11-member commission. Redmond will also serve as chairman. The commission is responsible for the administration of the newly established Education and Workforce Innovation Fund that will award matching grants for innovative education programs. School programs are eligible for awards up to $350,000 spread over 5 years. District and regional partnerships are eligible for a state award of up to $800,000 over 5 years. We run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.